they use them all the time, right? It's like, okay, here you are.
Yeah.
This is what percentile you're in. And those are very good. In terms of the number you want to typically be at, for men, like I always want to see over 50 kilos.
Mm-hmm.
For women, 40. Depends on age and things like that, right? So I want decent grip strength. Not as egregious, but similar to my comments about blood reference ranges. I don't love the reference ranges for grip strength. I think they're undershot.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should be more aggressive than that. But they're not unreasonable like many of the reference ranges for blood for biochemistry. So they're just all egregious. Now, a lot of people will talk about grip strength and they're like, oh, it's correlation, it's not causation. So, which is to say, like, it's an indicator of overall health, but it doesn't really matter itself. And I would say there is so much evidence to argue that. In fact, even more recently, a colleague of mine, Tommy Wood at the University of Washington, we published a paper this year, a couple of them. He published one as well. And when you look at grip strength, there is a strong indicator here. In fact, actually, another paper came out just recently on asymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
10%. So when you're looking at right hand versus left hand,
that makes sense.
Dominant versus non-dominant.
Yeah.
We typically have thought of it as like, well, your dominant hand is going to be stronger, and it is. But the issue they found there is when you have people that have more than a 10% asymmetry, this is a potential, and it's just one paper, which always means like, let's see if it's replicated.
Data, yeah.
Let's see if it comes from another lab as well. Like you've published, you're a scientist, you know. So don't be. But to me, it makes a ton of sense. But that 10% difference, when you start seeing greater than a 10%, you have an early indicator of some neurological denervation happening. So it's not just a random like, well, of course your grip, your dominant hand stronger. It is and should be. But if you, and we've seen this in our practice a lot, you know, people 20, 25, 30% differences in grip strength. Mm-hmm. Either you have some injury in that hand that, you know, you hurt your hand a long time ago, or something else is going on. And you don't want to have that. So we pay attention to that number at 10%. In terms of training, it's super easy. Do anything. The challenge is grip.
Just a squeezy ball.
Sure, if you want.
Yeah.
Deadlift, push things, drag things, carry things, hold things, use dumbbells, use kettlebells. Any number of things that challenge. Physiology is very straightforward from the perspective of adaptation. Meaning, we always say, like, look for the physiological limiter. The physiological limiter is also the place of adaptation. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing anything where your grip gives out and you're limited by your grip strength, it's then challenging your grip strength. It will adapt, you'll get stronger. So it doesn't really matter, right? Again, if you're lifting weights and you're doing rows, mm-hmm. pulling things to you, if you're using a machine and you're using straps on your wrist, well, now you're actually not limiting your grip strength at all. Mm-hmm. Great for your upper back, great for your potential biceps, awesome.
But you're not challenging your grip.
Not challenging your grip.
What if you wear gloves?
Gloves are fine, but now you're taking a little bit of grip away.
Yeah.
But still could possibly be doing it, right? I'm not against that entirely, although I have to be totally honest with you. Most of my soul dies when I see somebody using gloves.
Really?
Yeah, but I'm like, this is cultural, okay? I'll grant you that's not logic. That's just like, you don't wear gloves in the gym.
You wrote a paper I read briefly about. You can actually use epigenetic changes in response to resistance training.
Oh yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. Like, how does that affect you as a?
Some of the best moments in life are spontaneous, unplanned. But for men dealing with moderate to severe erectile dysfunction or ED, preparing for intimacy can rob you and your partner of spontaneity. The joy of living in the moment. Now you can restore that spark in your relationship with the AMS 700 implant. A clinically proven permanent solution designed for your satisfaction and your partner's. It's the number one physician-preferred implant. It's built to look and feel natural. Happy partners agree. 92% of patients and 96% of their partners report sexual activity with the implant excellent or satisfactory. It gives you the ability to respond to your partner's wishes in the moment, not minutes or hours later. The AMS 700, no pills, no injections, no waiting. For more information, visit edcure.org/podcast. That's edcure.org/podcast. Sponsored by Boston Scientific.
Your physiology.
Epigenetics is an emerging field, and by that, like, it's been around 20-ish years in sort of its current form, which is new in science, right? Like, that's a new thing. And so, yeah, we did one particular study, and we looked at the epigenetic responses in muscle following an acute bout of exercise. We did it in very sedentary people compared to people that are well-trained. And what we're trying to see there is, we know that there's a certain response in muscle or any organ system to challenge, but is that uniquely different between the two? The paper itself doesn't matter. Your question was better, which is, okay, like, how does that actually matter? So epigenetics, you have to understand them a little bit. When we went back earlier, we were talking about genetics. Genetics are very important for a lot of different things, of course. In terms of actionable steps, though, they are the least important part of the process because they only tell you about potential. They don't tell you about actualization. Genes mean nothing unless they're turned on. That's epigenetics. Okay, so how are they? This is a condensed, sort of easy version of epigenetics. So you can do a genetic test, and there are some things you can glean out of that, and there's a bunch of things that don't matter at all because they don't tell you anything about, did they actually net result in protein? Did you make that enzyme? Did you not make that? You don't know. You just knew about sort of, unless you find things that are clinical, genetic markers for genetic, this is what they're called, genetic diseases, right? Like different things there, or other factors that say, hey, your higher chances, lower chances of A, B, and C. But unless you actually look at the thing, you don't know if that chance made it or not, right? So epigenetics, some of those things can be carried from generation to generation. Many of them don't. Most acute things, like with exercise, are probably not going to carry over to the next generation. In this particular case, like, none of that stuff would.
Yeah.
We were just trying to understand, is that response unique, and if so, how? It was one of the first in the field, and so it was more of a descriptive than it was an actual intervention.
In terms of someone starting exercise, as just, let's say, general exercise, they're doing some resistance, some cardio that's actually challenging them, how quickly will they see benefits? Within weeks, within months, within years? And what sort of differences will they see?
Yeah. So it depends on how we want to define benefit. If you're trying to get stronger, how fast will it take before you actually notice changes on the bar? Can be as soon as the next test session, like, depending on how trained you are. Mm-hmm. The less trained you are, the faster you'll see changes. The more trained you are, the slower that stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in fact, this is in the field, we call these newbie gains.
Yeah.
They're like really,
they're like, oh my God, I got.
Yeah, it's like literally every time you go to the gym, you could put 5 more pounds on and you just continue to go up there. If there are other changes you're looking for, like, when am I going to start losing weight? When is my pain going to go away? When am I going to start having better energy? That can be, again, a day, could be a month, could be 6 months. It really depends on a lot of the things that are going on. But yeah, you can certainly see changes. In terms of muscle size, the number you're going to see there, and this is just very general science, typically the first 4 or so weeks of training, most of the adaptations are neural, meaning we don't have the precision of imaging yet to identify a statistically significant change in, like, muscle fiber size, though it's clearly happening. It just hasn't reached a threshold where we could notice it. And so if you're continuing to get strong at that point or whatever, it's probably because, you're getting more efficient, nervous systems being there. After that, now we can actually start measuring changes in muscle size. But again, that said, you go do a training session right now. Muscles can be larger for acute reasons, swelling, edema, things like that. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks later, like, you could actually have legitimate changes in muscle size. Again, it's mostly water, but if you continue at it, it'll stay there and you won't be able to tell the difference when it turns from water to contractile proper proteins anyways.
Interesting. And is it different? They say that it's much more difficult for women to gain muscle, particularly after menopause, right? But is it different? Is there actually science behind it?
Well, they say that, but they're not right.
It's not true.
No.
We're debunking myths here.
No, you actually know. There's another paper came out in the last couple of months. That's the same thing for people over 70. There's no difference in rate of improvement.
Really?
No.
Fascinating.
I don't know if you know this or not, but women have testosterone.
Oh, I know.
Did you know
I'm
that?
I'm a urologist. I know.
I was totally joking, right? Like, you're all over this one, right?
Yeah.
And it turns out you have a lot more testosterone than
estrogen.
You even have estrogen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Yeah.
People just think, like, it's nuts. That to say, women are completely anabolic, just like men are. You would be in a bad place if you were not anabolic. So there's just not any evidence to suggest the rate of increase really changes between men and women. You said it earlier perfectly. Men are absolutely bigger, generally.
Yeah.
So when you're both doing relative changes of the same percent and one is absolutely larger, you have absolutely more, generally, mass.
Yeah.
But the rate of increase doesn't seem to change. If you want to look at function, too, look at the sport of powerlifting. Look at the sport of Olympic weightlifting. Look at any of these strength-based one-rep max sports. And you see women continuing to progress in those sports like men are. And there's no reason to think that. We're continuing to break world records on both sides of the equation, and they're scaling. So there's no rationale to think that. Women just tend to be smaller.
Yeah, and that's physiologic.
Totally.
So
that's chromosomal. Like, yeah, you can tell that from chromosomes.
Yeah. Let's just talk about designing. This was actually a question from one of my audience. Designing the optimal regimen for someone who's got 20 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Let's say for fat loss as the primary goal, and then for muscle hypertrophy as the primary goal.
20 minutes a day every day, or 3 days a week, or what do we got?
Let's say 5 days.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. Let's say they had 5 days. If I had 30 minutes, I would probably do at least one day where that is what we call like gear one. So this is mouth closed, and you're breathing in and out through your nose at a controlled pace. I don't care what you're doing. This could be walking. This could be whatever. But we're going to be doing that lower end of the threshold. One of those days, I would certainly do at least one day that's the opposite, gear four. This could be intervals. This could be things like that. But we are going to burn as many calories as we can possibly do in an up-down fashion in there. I would certainly do 2 days a week without question of some sort of what we call kind of like general hypertrophy range lifting. Mm-hmm. So this is sets of 8 to 20 repetitions, plus or minus, something like that. We're pushing the pace on what would feel, we're doing whole body every time. We're not doing body part splits or things like that, right? So you're going to do upper body push and pull. You're going to do lower body press and pull. And we're going to do whole body movements, right? We're going to get you moving throughout the day. That gives me 4 days a week, right? The additional day, I might add either a continuous. So this would be maybe something that's more like gear 2 or gear 3, where it's still the 20 straight minutes, jogging, swimming, aerodyne, something like that. It is higher intensity than the previous one. But this is not like fall on the floor, sweat, throw up, things like that, right? It would probably be something like that as a stamp. And then from there, we would personalize and individualize it.
And then walking's not enough. You can't just walk for all of your cardio.
For fat loss?
Yeah.
You could.
You could.
The exchange is how much ground are you covering in that 30 minutes? Not much. So caloric expenditure is very low. So you could do that, but you would have to then pull more calories from food to get that balance correctly. But you absolutely can. Not the best strategy to just like walk, but it's also not a zero strategy. If you look at people who are in aesthetic sports, bodybuilders, physique, and things like that, you will see them add a lot of walking because it's the, here's why. When you're thinking about designing exercise programs, people tend to think about the front side, the input. They don't think about the output, which is to say you have to pay attention to what's called recoverable volume. So if I, in that program I gave you, if I just said, hey, we're going to do 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, hard as you possibly can for 30 seconds, 30 seconds of rest. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do that for all your workouts. That's the most calories you could possibly build. And you would be smashed after that.
Yeah.
Because once you get past like 80% intensity, recoverability does not go linear. It goes exponential. So going from 85 to 90 is way harder to recover from than going from 55 to 60. Going from 95 to 100 is way, way harder to recover from than going from 80 to 85. So this starts really, really digging into recoverability. Now, if you're doing that once or twice a week, it's fine. You got the recovery capacity. If this is all you're going after and the rest of your buckets are already pretty full of stress and you're not like empty, you don't have much left to go. And so it's like, okay, be careful there. If everything is dialed, you can get away with that. And we're talking low volume, fine. But if not, you don't want to do that because the recovery is so hard to get to. You're going to get now super hungry. You're going to have a hard time sleeping. You're going to get these swings of like, oh my God, I feel exhausted. I finished my workout and I'm completely crashed. Okay, I'm trouble sleeping, having trouble sleeping at night. And my motivation, like all these things start kicking in, like these signs and symptoms of like, this is a stressed physiology, your respiratory rate. Like this is the biggest gimme. Pay attention to respiratory rate.